In 2010, the largest oil spill in American history captivated the public's attention. Authorities told a story of a response effort that prevented a worst-case scenario. But if you ask some people who lived through the spill, they'll tell you a more complicated story.
They weren't attending to the workers.
I was bleeding from everywhere.
We were all lied to.
From Western Sound and APM Studios comes a new investigative podcast, Ripple, available now.
In Germany, members of a populist far-right political party reportedly met with neo-Nazis. That has sparked massive protests. Some say it's time to ban the AfD.
If the AfD gets forbidden, then another party starts. It's more about the people.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Racism in European soccer matches is not dying down. What could the next step be?
I don't know why the topic of racism doesn't have a zero-tolerance approach that then effectively means that the club is accountable for their fans.
Is forfeiting matches next?
And in Haiti, poverty and crime make life difficult. That makes this week's jazz festival even more special.
They need to breathe, and this festival brings that to the people.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us this Monday.
In Germany, the far-right political party has been around for more than a decade. The AfD, or Alternative for Germany in English, has significant public support and currently 78 seats in the German parliament. But there's been widespread protest of the party since news broke that members of the AfD had met with neo-Nazis to discuss mass deportations from Germany.
Over the weekend, people took to the streets to denounce the AfD. One of the largest protests was in Munich, where people were chanting, "Everyone together against fascism." Munich police said more than 100,000 people took part in that demonstration. The World's Joshua Koh was in Munich on Sunday.
So the protest took place on Ludwigstrasse, one of the grand boulevards of the city. The symbolism of this street is immense. In 1923, Nazis attempted a coup to take over Munich. That coup failed after a gun battle against police on this very street. And after Hitler was voted into power 10 years later, this was the site of Nazi marches. It's 6 lanes wide, and every inch of that space and blocks of side streets was just absolutely packed with protesters carrying signs, waving flags.
Josh, what are the crowd saying there?
Right there, they're chanting, "All of Munich hates the AfD." Police and organizers had to call off the march an hour into it. They said because of security concerns, there were just simply too many people.
Right, 100,000, as we said, and that's just one city. So a lot of people are protesting the AfD. Why now?
A couple weeks ago, an explosive investigation was published by a watchdog journalism nonprofit called Correctif. Reporters had staked out a hotel and slipped into a secret meeting that hosted AfD members, neo-Nazis, and members of the more moderate conservative parties. Participants allegedly discussed this idea of remigration, or re-migration, basically forced deportations. There were specific details as to how to do this. You know, for example, send 2 million people to a quote-unquote model state in North Africa. And not only migrants. According to the Correctiv investigation, it's also a proposal to send German citizens too. In particular, people of color and people who the far right call non-assimilated Germans. And that's a lot like what the Nazis proposed doing with the Jews. There was a plan to send them out of Europe into Madagascar. In recent decades, Germany has become quite a diverse country. About a quarter of the population now has what's called a Migrationshintergrund, or an immigrant background, you know, be it first, second, or third generation Germans. So this investigation outraged protesters I spoke to, like Carolina.
And why are you here today?
Because I think it's really, really important to go to the streets and to show that, like, the majority, or at least I hope it's the majority of the people, are still against the fascist and neo-nationalist tendencies that are happening right now in Germany.
The country has seen a rise in far-right extremism, and there's talk of even banning the AfD.
How realistic is that, though, Josh? I mean, they are a political party that's gained legitimacy in the system, and now they've got some support.
Yeah, well, I mean, Germany tried to ban another far-right party already. That one was the NPD, and that didn't work. And the AfD is popular in some very important regions right now. There are three elections coming up in September in East Germany, and polls are showing that in at least two of those regions, the AfD is favored to win. And their popularity extends beyond the East. A poll that came out last month indicated that nearly a quarter of Germans support the AfD now.
Yeah, and that is a lot of people. How much of a threat are the AfD in Germany?
Well, Marco, they're a big enough concern that members are already being monitored by Germany's domestic intelligence agency. And the AfD has tried to use this to say that they are the victims. But people I spoke to don't think that's the case. And that's why protesters like Fritz took to the streets on Sunday.
I'm here to fight for the democracy, for our rights, that the far right is not getting any stronger, and to show that we are more than them because they are quite loud, so we have to be louder now because now is the time.
And you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, the Nazis were defeated when they attempted a violent coup here in Munich. But they won at the ballot box in 1933. That year was on so many signs yesterday. People wrote things like 1933, never again. And that's what protesters say they're trying to prevent.
The World's Joshua Koh reporting in Munich on major protests against Germany's far-right AfD party.
The pattern keeps repeating itself. Migrants set off from the coast of West and North Africa headed for the shores of Europe, and European governments try harder and harder to stop them.
It's fueling anti-immigrant sentiments in Europe, with politicians there ready to match the mood with rhetoric. But that's not the case everywhere.
On one of Spain's Canary Islands off the Atlantic coast of Morocco, many locals say their hearts go out to the thousands of people arriving there. That's because many Spaniards have something in common with them.
The World's Jerry Haddon reports from the island of El Hierro, the smallest and westernmost of the Canaries.
So far, tens of thousands of mostly Senegalese have puttered into this port this fall, fleeing poverty, unrest. They often arrive sick and hungry, even dying of thirst. They're taken to shelters, but at the pier itself, they're leaving behind a rapidly growing flotilla of rickety wooden vessels. In one harbor, there are so many boats, authorities have hired a contractor to smash them up and burn them. Watching from the nearby boardwalk is fisherman Francis Albert Suarez and his elderly aunt Flora. They both say they feel anguish with each overcrowded vessel that arrives. Things have got to be rough for these folks back home to come all the way here, Flora says. It takes days of navigating on the ocean. It's sad. And how many of them, wonders Francis, have just disappeared on the journey? Some NGOs estimate up to a quarter of the migrants on this route are never heard from again. Francis Suarez says he empathizes because he once nearly lost his own father somewhere out there in the blue. He'd gone out on a routine fishing trip. The engine on my dad's boat broke down, and they drifted for 9 days, he recalls. They had no food, barely any water. Suarez says the family was distraught as they waited for news. The whole family was just destroyed, he says. By a miracle, he was rescued. So when I see these migrants, he says, I put myself in their shoes. Suarez's empathy seems pretty widespread on El Hierro, in part because nearly every family has their own harrowing high seas story to tell, whether they fish or not. In the not-so-distant past, those Ereños, as they're called, found themselves in pretty much the same boat as the migrants arriving here today. In this Spanish TV documentary from decades ago, a group of Ereños sing of their own flight from poverty. The year was 1950. We were 124 on board that tiny ship, the song starts. It was called the Nuevo Adán. Our destination, Venezuela.
La vida en ese tiempo se hacía imposible debido a la guerra civil que hubo en España, que había todo estaba racionado, no corría el dinero.
We left during the tough years after the Spanish Civil War, recounts one of the unidentified migrants. Life was impossible on El Hierro, he says. There was no money. People were going hungry. Back then, El Hierro's population was around 17,000. Several thousand desperate residents fled, leaving at night on clandestine ships. Clandestine, because at the time, the Spanish dictator, Francisco Franco, wasn't letting anyone leave Spain, says historian Emilio Hernández.
El franquismo tenía a la gente un poco acotada. Sobre todo a partir del año 48, que es el denominado año de la seca en el hierro.
But then, in 1948, a massive drought hit, he says. Islanders, who were mostly farmers and shepherds, began looking to the Americas for salvation. But reaching salvation was not easy. Most of the smuggler ships were hardly seaworthy, sporting ragged sails and cracked hulls, like the Nuevo Adán. On day 33 at sea, recalls the man from the documentary, the captain shared some really bad news with the passengers.
Tengo que contarles la verdad. Estoy perdido de rumbo.
I have to tell you the truth, he told us. I'm off course. We're lost. Imagine how we felt then, the man says, terrified, exhausted, believing we were going to die of hunger out there. One fellow passenger on the Nuevo Adán was Nicolás Acosta. His grandson, Samuel Acosta, is a shepherd and seed collector on El Hierro. He continues the story as it was told to him.
¿Ellos se les acabó la comida? ¿Se les acabó el agua?
They ran out of food at sea, he says, then water. Finally, they decided to draw straws, to choose who among them they would sacrifice to eat.
Decían que lo más cruel no era pasar hambre, sino pasarse. Están bebiendo agua del mar.
But the hunger wasn't even the cruelest part, he says. It was the thirst. They were drinking seawater and getting sick. And then, a miracle.
Fueron 36 días el viaje. Nos vimos dentro del río Orinoco en la madrugada.
It was day 36, says the survivor in the documentary, and we woke up in the morning to see that we were at the mouth of the Orinoco River in Venezuela. We dipped our plates into that water and filled bottles and drank and drank. Everyone, all 124 passengers on the Nuevo Adán, survived. And many, including Nicolás Acosta, eventually returned to El Hierro with fortunes great or small. Fisherman Francis Suarez says he understands why they returned. It's home. He says it's why he feels for the Senegalese today.
Si estuvieras bien allá, no venías. Olvídate.
If you have everything you need at home, where you're from, he says, you don't leave. It's that simple. But if you do have to go, says Venancio Acosta, another island historian, you do best to remember who helped you along the way. His grandfather sailed in secret for Venezuela, too.
Se dan ahora mismo en estos países del occidente africano.
There are so many similarities between our family's escape and the Senegalese who are coming this way today, he says. In fact, my grandfather's boat stopped in Senegal for supplies. The fishermen there, he says, gave them food. So, he says, how could we not repay the kindness? For the World, I'm Jerry Haddon on El Hierro, the Canary Islands, Spain.
Malaria kills 600,000 people in Africa each year, most of them children. It's a mosquito-borne disease that public health authorities have long battled. After decades of research, starting today, children are receiving a new vaccine against malaria. The rollout is beginning in Cameroon, which hopes to get shots into the arms of 250,000 children in the next 2 years.
Two malaria vaccines have recently been approved. Cameroon will be using the first of the two. Mosquirix, it's called, developed by GlaxoSmithKline. Admittedly, the vaccine is imperfect, 30% effective, and requires 4 shots. But the World Health Organization says its use would still dramatically reduce severe infections and hospitalizations.
A second vaccine developed by Oxford University could prove to be more practical when it is ready for use. The Gavi Vaccine Alliance is working with 20 African countries to administer the malaria vaccine program, hoping to reach 6 million children by next year. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. European soccer is once again dealing with the ugly presence of racism during matches. Over the weekend, 2 incidents of racial abuse interrupted play in Europe. The situation has many fans and players wondering if any meaningful change will ever come to professional soccer. The World's Bianca Hillier has more.
In the UK on Saturday, Coventry City was up 2-1 in a match against Sheffield Wednesday when midfielder Casey Palmer won a throw-in. As soon as he got to the sideline, though, Palmer immediately reacted to something in the crowd. Cameras captured a small group of people in the stands appearing to make racist, monkey-like gestures toward Palmer, who is black. He ran over to tell the referee, and the game was stopped for a few minutes. Coventry City coach Mike Robbins condemned the incident after the match.
Nobody should have to deal with that. There's no place in society for it. I'm hoping that, you know, they've got a clear picture of what's gone on and they deal with them properly, because that's just out of order.
Local police have since said they're investigating the incident. Meanwhile, in Italy, a very similar scene was playing out against another black player, AC Milan goalie Mike Maignan.
It was a game for a moment. I just wonder if he's having a problem.
No, I think there's something going on with the crowd, and the referee's saying, hold on a minute, let's go and have a look.
Maignan left the field and walked toward the locker room, and some players from both teams followed in solidarity. They then returned to the pitch and resumed play. After the match, he explained what happened.
Primo rinjo, sono andato a prendere la palla, ho sentito dei rumori di scimmia. Prima volta ho detto niente.
Maignan said he heard people behind the goal making monkey noises. He said he ignored the chants at first, but when it kept happening, he told officials what was going on. Maignan called for strong sanctions against the behavior because, quote, talking no longer does anything. Troy Townsend agrees. He's head of player engagement at Kick It Out, an anti-racism organization in England.
We have been an advocate for a very long time around deduction of points. We do it in other scenarios. We do it when there's financial implications.
Townsend spoke with Sky Sports yesterday.
I don't know why the topic of racism doesn't have a zero tolerance approach that then effectively means that the club is accountable for their fans.
In a statement on X, FIFA President Gianni Infantino called the events, quote, totally abhorrent and completely unacceptable. He also called for an automatic forfeit for the team whose fans have committed racism. Many fans of the game are now questioning how that would work and if Infantino will, in fact, follow through on the proposed rule. Critics are already pointing to FIFA's historic lack of action on the issue, and FIFA declined to answer questions regarding policy details. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In Jerusalem today, a committee meeting in the Knesset, Israel's parliament, was disrupted by protesters, including relatives of Israeli hostages in the Gaza Strip.
One man shoved into the room and yelled at lawmakers, "It can't go on like this. You won't sit here while our children die over there."
The relatives of the 100-plus hostages who remain in Gaza have become a powerful pressure group in Israel. They're worried that the Israeli authorities are not doing enough to bring them home. And last month, Israeli troops accidentally shot and killed three hostages in Gaza.
Since then, officials have signaled a shift in strategy, but it's unclear what exactly that means as Israeli troops continue today to push into the southern city of Khan Yunis.
Amid the continued fighting, the high-ranking officials who make up the country's war cabinet appear to be more divided than ever. To understand all this, earlier today I spoke with Ehud Eiran. He was a foreign policy aide to former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and he's an associate professor in international relations at Haifa University. I started by asking what this storming of the meeting at Parliament revealed about support for the protest movement.
I think they have some support. You know, all Israelis, I guess, are sympathetic to the situation, but are divided on what needs to be done. People who are closer to the current government or support it prefer to go ahead with the military operation in Gaza, even if it means, in practice, leaving the hostages, you know, in Hamas jails.
So the people who have been demonstrating for the hostages to come home, how exactly do they want the government or military to make that happen?
They want the government to reach an agreement with Hamas. One problem with that is that it will probably place severe limitations on Israel's ability to operate militarily in Gaza.
So it's seen as an either-or, bring the hostages home or continue the campaign against Hamas?
Yes, it is in fact the military pressure that can release the hostages. Most commentators and definitely the families feel that it is indeed an either-or situation.
The Israeli government says that it's shifting to a less intense offensive strategy in Gaza. What does that mean?
It means stopping what is called in Israel the maneuver, moving quickly and trying to capture more territory, holding the positions as they are now, and conducting raids on some targets in southern Gaza, like the operation that's unfolding in Khan Yunis.
I want to ask you now about the war cabinet that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu created after the October 7th attack to manage this campaign in Gaza. One of its members, Gadi Eisenkot, has been speaking out about the divisions inside of the war cabinet. He's a former IDF chief of staff, and his son and his nephew have died in this war. What has he been saying?
So he somewhat surprised the public in a very candid interview in which he said, we should bring the hostages back first. This is coupled with leaks from the cabinet, probably from him, that Netanyahu is extending the war to serve his political goals.
Eisenkot has called for elections, which in Israel's system requires a majority vote in the Knesset to trigger. Is that more likely now than in the past because of, I don't know, this protest movement or these emerging rifts within the war cabinet?
The war in general is a huge political risk for Netanyahu. Israel's government failure to defend its citizens, to respond effectively after the attack, are all reasons that would lead you to believe that there should be political instability. But Netanyahu still has a very strong, tight coalition. So this is not the immediate end of the Netanyahu government.
So you're not anticipating an election being called anytime soon?
Not in the immediate future.
So if leadership did change during the war, and for example, Benny Gantz, one of the ministers in the war cabinet, who's, you know, also the leader of another party, you think that the war would come to an end?
It's hard to say, but I think the chances will be higher that it will end, or at least we'll have clearer goals with a clear timeline and an exit strategy. Because Gantz and Eisenkot, his partner, are much more open to a political process compared to Netanyahu.
How have you been feeling watching those divisions start to emerge?
I generally think it's a positive thing, especially during times of war. Multiplicity of voices and people who challenge the mainstream are important. The government, in my view, did not set realistic war aims and did not include the political process with the Palestinians or political goal at the end.
Ehud Eran was an advisor to former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. He's currently an associate professor in international relations at Haifa University.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. The military in Ukraine is not just attacking Russian invaders, it's also hitting targets deep inside Russian territory.
Oil refineries and railroads, rail links, industrial facilities, military factories, civilian and dual-use factories are all on that list.
Ukraine's capabilities, how far its military can strike its adversary. Still ahead, here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Authorities in the Italian city of Bologna want drivers to slow down, so they just imposed a 30-kilometer-per-hour speed limit on its city center. That's about 19 miles an hour.
Bologna is the first major city in Italy to lower its speed limit. Other places in Europe have done the same. They're trying to make roads safer. But as we hear from our Europe correspondent Orla Berry, not everyone is happy with the change.
On the day the new speed limit came into force in Bologna, drivers working for NCC, a private taxi company, formed a long convoy and drove at a snail's pace through the city's streets, honking their horns in protest. Some local residents weren't happy either.
Penso che ci sarà molto più traffico rispetto a prima.
I think there'll be a lot more traffic than before, this resident tells Rai 24 television. The measure was introduced by the city's mayor, Matteo Lepore, last week.
L'obiettivo della Città 30 sono zero morti sulle strade.
The goal is zero road deaths, the left-wing mayor told reporters. It's not about the number of fines handed out, it's about reducing fatalities, he said. Lepore faces an uphill battle. Not even the country's transport minister has his back.
A Bologna, per scelta del sindaco e della sinistra che governa, tutti a 30 all'ora.
It's an ideological and senseless choice, Matteo Salvini, the minister, said in a post on social media. And it will cause chaos for workers. Salvini, who's also the leader of the far-right League Party, says he's thinking about forcing the city to ditch the plan. Bologna is following in the footsteps of other European cities like Brussels, Paris and Madrid that have all introduced a 30-kilometre speed limit. In Brussels, the measure came into force back in 2021.
The reactions were polarized. Do you say it in English, polarized?
Inge Pahman is with Brussels Mobility, a government-funded company responsible for infrastructure in the Belgian capital.
People living in Brussels were very happy with the measure, and people coming to Brussels were not happy at all.
Pahman says even today, 3 years later, some people are still complaining. But the results speak for themselves, she says. The fatality rate from car crashes is down and the severity of injuries suffered by pedestrians is much lower. And there's an added bonus, Pahman says.
Before the 30-kilometre limit, 64% of the population suffered from noise, from traffic, and now it's only 30%.
Earlier this month, Wales took things one step further. The Welsh government introduced a 20-mile-per-hour speed limit in almost all cities and towns across the country. Residents talking to local news outlet Wales Online had mixed views on the new restrictions.
They slow down things like commutes and emergency services.
It's something we need to do for the safety and for the environment.
If people have been driving in these areas for years, it's just going to be too hard to change.
Sustrans, a cycling non-profit in the UK, says the government is on the right track.
It's still obviously a controversial and big topic of conversation in Wales. You know, many people are just getting used to it still, really. So I think the Welsh government has taken a very bold decision.
But Stephen Cunha, the group spokesperson in Cardiff, says just like in Italy, there's been a political backlash. The Welsh government is led by the left-wing Labour Party, and in the last few weeks, several right-wing politicians have come out against the move, including Conservative lawmaker Natasha Asgar.
I've spoken to firefighters. In fact, a retained firefighter got in touch with me and he said, look, Natasha, if I get a 999 page or, for example, a call, I have to make it from my home to the fire station at 20 miles per hour. So when it comes to, for example, a house on fire, they are going to get there slower.
Stephen Connor says he doesn't believe that's going to happen.
Let's just be clear. When emergency services are responding with a blue light, they have an exemption to any speed limit. So yeah, there's no reason to think they'd be affected by a change in a speed limit on a specific street.
Connor says there may be some issues that still need ironing out. But if so many major cities across Europe can do it, he says, why not Wales? After all, Connor says, ultimately, it's about saving lives. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The U.S. military says that two Navy SEALs who went missing 10 days ago are now considered dead. Navy Special Warfare Operator Second Class Nathan Gage Ingram, age 27, of Texas, and Navy Special Warfare Operator First Class Christopher J. Chambers, age 37, of Maryland. They were lost in the Arabian Sea during a mission to confiscate Iranian missile components. Officials said a raid on January 11th targeted an unflagged ship carrying illicit Iranian-made weapons to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. They said Ingram was boarding the ship when he fell into the rough seas below, and Chambers jumped in to try and save him.
The U.S. Navy ultimately sunk the unflagged ship carrying the weapons after deeming it unsafe. 14 crew members on that ship were detained. The U.S. Navy and its partners have been seizing weapons shipments bound for Houthi rebels. The Houthis have launched a series of attacks in the Red Sea that threaten global trade.
Since the two SEALs went missing, more than 21,000 square miles of sea have been searched by the military and other partners, with no sign of the two service members. U.S. Central Command says the search is now a recovery effort.
It has been nearly 2 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine began, and the war appears to be at a stalemate. Both militaries continue to strike their adversaries' civilian infrastructure. On Friday, Ukrainian drones were suspected of causing a blast at a Russian oil depot about 40 miles inside Russian territory. Ukraine has sent drones hundreds of miles past its own border, close to Moscow and St. Petersburg. Samuel Bendit is a military expert with the Center for Naval Analysis in Washington.
Well, the thinking is Ukraine is going after Russian military infrastructure and the infrastructure that supports the military, as well as going after the main economic nodes, as well as infrastructure points like the oil facilities and everything that's related to them, considering how important oil is to the Russian economy, and obviously considering how energy is important to the Russian budgets, as well as the conduct of war, this strike was probably inevitable.
How has Ukraine's long-range capabilities to strike within and sometimes deep within Russian territory evolved over the course of the conflict?
Well, they started striking Russian territory at the end of 2022 to demonstrate that they can reach inside the European part of Russia, to demonstrate that they can hit Russian military bases as well as Russian cities. We have to remember that in 2023, Ukraine conducted a strike well into the heart of Moscow. They actually hit the Kremlin. But striking civilian targets is not necessarily forcing Russia to do anything, since the Russian society is mostly resigned to this conflict and to this war. And so in order to be successful, Ukraine has to go after the industrial infrastructure, after the infrastructure that supports the war effort. And of course, energy, oil refineries and railroads, rail links, industrial facilities, military factories, civilian and dual use factories are all on that list.
And so far, how significant to the defense effort have these long-range strikes on Russian military infrastructure been for Ukraine?
Well, the consequences of such strikes are usually long-term. Most of the times, Russia is able to, let's say, put out the fires, both literally and metaphorically. But at the same time, there are some effects. For example, the oil prices rose somewhat after the strike on the oil facility in the St. Petersburg region. The effects are not always clear because Russian media doesn't always publish what the actual effect is and what the consequences are. And so Ukraine is also demonstrating that just as Russia is able to hit Ukrainian infrastructure with its missiles and drones, the war also comes on the Russian territory. And so the strikes on the Russian territory today are almost a daily occurrence, both with short-range, mid-range, and long-range kamikaze-type drones.
You've mentioned both drones and missiles as long-range weaponry that has been striking well within Russian territory. How are these drones and missiles being used differently?
Well, they're actually used in a complementary fashion. Oftentimes, the drones are launched to illuminate and identify air defense sites and locations, which are then either hit by missiles or with the course of the missile flight path, basically evading some of these air defense sites. Sometimes it's the other way around. But for Russia, for example, the long-range strikes by Shahed drones are essentially done as surrogates to Russian missile strikes. A lot of these long-range drones are really cheap replacements for much more expensive long-range missiles. For Ukraine, the situation is somewhat similar, but Ukraine has fewer capabilities, and so Ukraine has to be very judicious in what it strikes and why it attacks certain Russian locations, which is why, again, the focus here is shifting from demonstrative strikes into the Russian civilian locations like the cities, including Moscow, and more towards the infrastructure that actually feeds the war effort.
So how do these longer-range strike capabilities hitting military targets specifically fit into Ukraine's current military strategy in, you know, January 2024, almost 2 years in?
Well, Ukraine has to slow down Russian advances. Ukraine has to impede the Russian war effort writ large, meaning it is doing so on the battlefield, but it's also doing so. It is striking infrastructure facilities. It is striking defense industry, civilian industry that supports the military effort deep inside the Russian territory. And so, again, Ukraine has already demonstrated that it has missiles as well as long-range drones that can reach deep into the Russian heartland, essentially into the entire European part of the Russian territory where the bulk of the population, commerce, and industry are located. Now Ukraine has to go after very specific sites which are part of the Russian war effort. And so again, energy infrastructure are very much on that list, both, for example, in the occupied territories of Ukraine as well as deep inside Russia proper.
Samuel Bendit is a senior advisor with the Center for Naval Analyses. He joined us from Washington.
Haiti might be one of the poorest countries economically in the Western Hemisphere, but anyone who's been there knows that Haitian culture is immensely rich. And despite serious security challenges, the arts are still flourishing. Take, for instance, Haiti's annual Pop Jazz Festival. Last year's festival drew thousands of fans. This year marks the 17th edition of the annual Pop Jazz. It begins Thursday. Malena Sandler is one of the festival organizers. She spoke with me this morning from Port-au-Prince.
We're very excited to come back to Port-au-Prince because last year we held the festival in Cap Haitien, the second city of the country, and we're back in Port-au-Prince.
So we're talking 4 days of music, jazz from all over the world, a really impressive international lineup, 42 concerts, and 29 of them are free. Talk about the audience that this event attracts. Are the attendees from around Haiti, other parts of the Caribbean? Where are they from?
They're from Haiti, from the whole country. We have people coming from Martinique and the diaspora, so Miami.
So let's focus on one of the artists at the festival. I mean, as I said, really impressive international lineup, but the band Guolobo represent some of the Haitian musicians headlining this event. Tell us about Guolobo and what they mean to Haitian music lovers.
It's a young band. It's their third year of existence. They play a mix of traditional Haitian music mixed with electric guitar and DJs. Their sound is Vodou Tech. It's a little bit of Raratek, blues, reggae, traditional music, DJs, and Afrobeat. They do all of that. So we're very happy and proud to have them.
That's Guolobo with their Vodou Tech. They're appearing at Haiti's 2024 Pop Jazz Festival this week, starting Thursday. Milena, interestingly, I mean, it's an international festival, but this is also a mentorship program for Haitian musicians, especially young musicians. How do they figure into the forefront at this festival?
So every morning, the international bands that are programmed at the festival held workshops every morning. And every night, we have the after-hours jam sessions. We feature a local emerging band, and the festival team and the headliners go and eat in that restaurant, and the jam happens or not, but it usually does, meaning the local musicians get to play with the stars that we feature, and that's amazing.
That's very cool. Does the Pop Jazz Festival break new artists? I mean, is this a kind of discovery moment for young Haitian artists?
It is. You know, they get to learn in the morning and jam at night. It's a big part of the festival.
As you said, Milena, the festival had to be moved last year to Cap Haitien for security. It's back in Port-au-Prince this year. Still, the security challenges must be immense. Is this festival about how the arts continue to flourish in Haiti, or is it a statement of determination that violence will not let the arts suffer?
It's an act of resistance. The people of Port-au-Prince need that festival. They need food, they need security, they need everything. But they also need a space of conviviality, of hope. They need to breathe. And this festival brings that to the people. We've been doing it for 17 years. 2 times we didn't have the festival when the earthquake in Port-au-Prince happened in 2010. The earthquake happened 10 days before the opening of the festival, and we didn't do it in 2022. So we have taken extraordinary measures to hold the festival in Port-au-Prince.
Milena, I don't want to dwell on the problems in Port-au-Prince, but you do have a logistical challenge putting on a jazz festival in a violent city. What are the new security measures you're putting in place for this year?
Okay, so usually the festival is over 8 days. 5 days in a public space accessible to anyone, and 3 days in a ticketed environment, in a hotel or whatever. This year, we will not do the festival in a public space because anything can be, you know, just somebody laughing too loud. Everybody's a little bit on edge. So we are doing 4 days of the festival, and we're doing it in a hotel, in Caribe Hotel. And we have the after hours, which are free every night. We also have the workshops that are free.
It sounds really dynamic and does offer something for a lot of people. I was struck with your comment about how much Haitians need this space of hope and friendship. Realistically, what are your hopes that Pop Jazz will do for music fans and Haitian musicians?
It's been difficult to do this festival every year. We've had times where we had to cancel the opening and do it on another day. We had to postpone it 3 months. So we are used to having challenges. And the public is always showing up. Social cohesion only happens in this country very rarely. It happens at Carnival, which is hardly held anymore, but it happens at pub jazz. Every people in the population gets to be together. It's a music that elevates you. The festival is all about that.
That was Milena Sandler speaking with us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, where she's one of the organizers of the 2024 Pop Jazz Festival that starts this Thursday.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In the past year, tens of thousands of people from Venezuela have fled violence and instability in their country and arrived in the state of Colorado. Most get there by bus from border states like Texas. Many will continue north, but others are looking for work in communities across the Rocky Mountain state. Libia Guzman is one of them. She fled Venezuela and shared her story with Aspen Public Radio, explaining the challenges she faced getting to the U.S. and her plans now that she's in Colorado. A note that Guzman's story includes some details about violent crime and may not be suitable for all listeners.
In Venezuela, I belong to the military forces. When you do the military service, they teach you to protect the people, not to harm the people. So I refused to do certain things. They wanted me to shoot people, to kill human beings. No, I said that is not accepted by God. God can forgive a lot, but not taking another life. So I refused. I escaped. The Tren de Aragua organization came to get me, and my sister hid me in a farm while she was selling the house and all that. I ran to Colombia, then to Peru. And when I got to Peru, that organization arrived in Peru. So I called my nephew, who was in Chile, and I asked him to come with me and see what he could do. So I saw on YouTube that people were crossing the jungle, Darien jungle, to come to the U.S. So I walked with my nephew, and we got to the border with Peru and Ecuador. When I arrived, there were some men that knew me, so I crossed to Ecuador, Colombia. I stayed 5 days in the jungle, and after crossing the jungle with my nephew, his wife, and another guy, the Panamanian militarists, took us in trucks, in different trucks, and separated us. I didn't see my nephew anymore. And I walked 21 kilometers to a church. When I got to the church, my brother sent me $40. And I continue with the little I was able to save. I got to Guatemala. I was there about 3 months trying to get some money because Guatemala is the last place where you can get help before getting to Mexico. Because Mexico is very difficult. So I went in a caravan of 5,000 to 6,000 people walking to cross Mexico. You have to go in a group because otherwise immigration will send you back and starting all over is hard. So I walked and walked and we got to a place that is called El Basurero, the dump, where you can take the train, the beast. So I got onto the beast and I was there for 6 days. I wished I was dead. It was like torture. I had no food. People would throw food, but I was never lucky enough to get anything. We got to the capital city of Juarez. I met my nephew in Juarez, and I was so happy. So when we got on the bus, and other people arrived with guns, and they stopped the bus, suddenly we were kidnapped. So they took the phone so they could call our families, asking us to ask them to send the money. And if they could not send the money, we had to say goodbye. I saw them kill a boy. They did it so we would see it was true. And I felt that it was going to be my death because I had no money. So I looked at the kidnapper in the eyes, prayed to God, and I lied to him. I told him, I'm pregnant. Please don't kill me. I don't know where that idea came from, but it worked. And he asked me, how far are you in the pregnancy? And I said, 4 months. So a man, their boss, I don't know, came and told them to let us go.
Estuve en Texas, en El Paso. Pasaje de Texas a Denver costaba $95.
I was in Texas, in El Paso. The ticket from Texas to Denver was $95. We came to Denver. When we got here, I met my girlfriend that has helped me a lot. She's from Honduras, and she's the one that has supported me and helped me. And she loaned me her car and covers so I could sleep in her car. She helped me with food, and thanks to her and her kids, that has made me feel like living. And I want to help them. They are the kids that God gave me, and every day they make me want to live and continue to fight. I came here because in Denver, I went to an emergency shelter, but it wasn't my environment. There were many sick people with drugs, and I felt unsafe.
Me quiero quedar por aquí, aquí en Aspen, donde sea, porque...
I would like to stay here in Aspen, because it's quiet, it's safe. And if there is a job, I'm fine. That's what I really want to do. I want to get a job so I can help them and start to help my family in Venezuela.
Y de ahí después de trabajar, mi sueño es ser abogado.
Once I can work, my dream is to be a lawyer and defend people who have no money, because in my country, there's a lot of injustice. That's what I always wanted to do since I was a kid. I miss my nephews who are there, but I want to work and help them. Everything is expensive. We make $15 a week, and that's not enough. For example, my nephews live in a little shack, so I want to work so I can help them with the house, help them to study, to be somebody in life. I'm not fully legal yet, but I hope I will be. Now we're all together with the kids. They call me mom, and if you open the door, they will run and call me mom. And that fills me with joy and motivation.
Yo soy un angelito, ella es un angelito, y ellos son nuestro angelito, y entre nosotros mismos nos vamos a apoyar.
We are all little angels. My partner is an angel, I'm an angel, and the little kids are angels too. And we are going to support each other.
That was Libia Guzman, who fled Venezuela and is now living in Colorado. She told her story to Hallie Zander. This story was produced by Aspen Public Radio with help from the Public Media Journalists Association Editor Corps.
That is our program for this Monday. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for listening. We will see you right back here tomorrow.